been Joe Hoerner, left-handed relief pitcher. 14-year major league career, 500 games, 100 saves, and two different tours of duty in Philadelphia. Joe, it's been my pleasure to talk to you today. Society for American Baseball Research, thanks you very much for your time.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. I'd just like to say, add one thing here. My first stint here in Philadelphia, I got to know Jim Bunning real well, and a lot of people ask me, you know, what was there anybody in that you ran along to in your career that maybe helped you or added time to your career or whatever? And I definitely have to say, when I got here and saw Jim Bunning and met him and got to be friends and saw his work habits, you know, and Jim was a little bit older, and Jim stuck around and still was very successful at an older age, especially for a baseball pitcher. And to see Jim work as hard as he worked between starts to keep himself in good shape and to be ready both physically and mentally, I said to myself, I'll never forget, we were in Pittsburgh running in the outfield, and Jim and I were talking, and he kind of said, I said something to him, I said, Jim, I really admire the dedication you have to keeping yourself in good shape. And he said, Joe, you're going to find out. He said, you're getting there. You're going to get a little older. It's going to be a little tougher. He said, you're going to have to find out. You've got to work a little bit harder. And I never forget those words. And I said to myself later, I said, by golly, if Jim Bunning can go out there and do that little extra and push himself, I said, Joe Hoerner, younger than he is, he can do it too. And I'll never forget, I think from that day on, I probably took care of myself a little better and worked a little harder to stay in shape. And I know that added maybe 3-4 years to my career, you know, and I'll never forget those words that day, you know, and how true it is that Jim said, you get a little older, you know, we think about being 37, 38 years old, you know, that's not really old, you know, but in this game, it is old, you know, so I'll never forget that, and then I bring it up to Jim a lot, you know, and we're still good friends, and I guess him and Bob Gibson, who I had the pleasure of playing for in St. Louis, were about the same way. Bob worked as hard as anybody I've ever seen, and probably the best athlete I ever ran across.
Harlem Globetrotter.
Yeah, Bob, I think Bob would have been a superstar in anything he would have decided to do, barring injury. I mean, he would have been an excellent basketball player. He was an excellent baseball player. They say he was an excellent football player. No matter whatever he decided to do, it would have been good, barring injury. The only thing, I guess, the closing, I just, to this day, can't figure out why Jim Bunning is not in the Hall of Fame. It's just not fair. I mean, you look at his stats, 100 games in both leagues, all-star pitchers, perfect game, no hitters, all the things he done, and I just don't understand some of the writers not wanting him in the Hall of Fame. It's just a shame that he's not there, because he definitely belongs there.
Most of the folks here in Philadelphia feel the same way about Jim. It's every year when the vote comes up, same old thing. Why isn't he there?
Even in St. Louis, the writers in St. Louis, you know, you talk to them and they say, oh, well, he'll be elected this year. He belongs there, you know. The election's over and he's not there yet, you know. And I don't understand it where, I guess he upset some writers somewhere along the line that, I mean, there's people there that, if they belong there, some of the people that are there, if they belong there, Jim Bunning definitely belongs there.
Yeah, we all feel that way in Philadelphia, too.
And he'll get there, I guess. Maybe someday he'll get there, but hopefully it's not too late for Jim to enjoy it himself, because he definitely belongs there.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to do any touring when you're in Philadelphia?
No, we're going back tomorrow. Like I said, the 2.5 years we spent here, we got to see a lot of Philly. Mm-hmm. And met some good friends. They're coming down to the hotel today to see us. And we got to go back tomorrow. I got a big group, approximately 100 people, going to Montreal Wednesday with the Cardinals. So I got to get back and get regrouped, and Wednesday go up to Montreal with the group. And so it's been a busy summer throughout the travel agency, and enjoy it. And I think I'm enjoying watching the Cardinals this year. Of course, the turnaround they took with getting rid of a lot of free agents and a lot of big money people, with like Coleman and McGee and Pendleton and Daly and a lot of people, and went with a bunch of rookies and kind of got crucified in the newspaper. Del Maxwell did, the general manager, but those young kids are 4 games out of first place this morning.
Well, that's it's good to see that happen.
It sure is. It's excuse me, even the people in St. Louis, the fans, kind of said, oh my goodness, you know, we're going to have a terrible year, you know. And attendance was down a little bit early, but now they're filling the ballpark every day, you know. So no matter who you got on the field, if you win, they're going to come see you.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But so I've watched that real close, and like I said, I see quite a few of the games, and it's still a wonderful game. It's done an awful lot for me in my career. I took a little farm boy off the farm in Dubuque, Iowa, and whenever, 1957, and seen an awful lot of things. I just about, well, I was out of high school. I had a scholarship at the University of Iowa, and my mom and dad were very happy that I was going to go to college. And I guess one of the toughest decisions I remember making, when it came time to go to school that fall, I told them I didn't want to go to college, and I really broke their hearts. And I said, I want to play baseball. I know I can play Major League Baseball, you know. Like every other 18-year-old kid, you know, knows all the answers to the solve all the world's problems. Yeah. You know, I had three of them. But I'll never forget telling them that. And I know that I just broke their hearts that I wasn't going to go to college. And I'll never forget telling them, told them both that. I said, I know I can pitch, and I know I can be successful. And I said, it'll all be rewarding. I said, like I said, like everybody knows at that age what's happening. You know, I said, I'll get to the big leagues. I'm playing a World Series. I'll play in an All-Star game. It'll all be worth not going to college. And luckily, it all happened for me, you know. My dad is still living, and my mom passed away in my last year, 1977, so she got to see it all. And so it was fun, but I'll never forget that day, telling them how good I was going to be and whatever. Like my children told me at different times, you know, and they had the answers to everything, but it worked for me. But great career, great game, a lot of fun.
Do you see the same game when you watch a game on television?
Oh, I don't know. I sometimes don't think so. I don't look like they're, I don't know. It's a good game, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not downgrading any of the players. It's a tough game, you know. It's a tough game. But I just, sometimes I don't think I see the total desire and the 100% effort as maybe back 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, we played to get paid next year, you know. Today, they're getting paid 3-4 years. They already know where they're going to make 3-4 years ahead of time, you know. So I'm not quite sure if the full desire is there like it was then.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joe, I want to thank you again for your time, and we'll see you down at the ballpark tonight.
I'll be there.
And good luck when they bring you in.
Thank you. Thank you.
Joe Horner from the St. Louis Cardinals and Philadelphia Phillies. This is Dan DiNardo with the Society for American Baseball Research. Good morning, everyone. This is Dan DiNardo with the Society for American Baseball Research, the Oral History Project. We're here in Philadelphia on August the 10th, 1991, to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the opening of Veterans Stadium. One of the Phillies' left-handed pitchers is with me today, Woody Fryman. Woody, welcome back to Philadelphia.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Woody, let's go back to the early days of your career. The Pirates came out and signed you. How did they find you, and who did they send out?
Well, that was kind of odd. I was just went to tryout camp, and they seen me in 1961, and they wanted to sign me at that time, but I wanted a bonus, and they wouldn't give me one, because I was just playing sandlot ball at the time, too, because I didn't go to high school or college, and that's all the ball I was playing just on Sunday afternoon. So, they wouldn't give me any money to sign, so I didn't sign. So 4 or 5 years later, they came back again, and I was still playing sandlot ball, and they ended up signing me. Still no money, but I ended up signing with them, and then 6 weeks later, I was in the big leagues with Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to go to Pittsburgh?
Well, it didn't really get matter where I went. It was about 3 or 4 clubs at the time that was trying to sign me, but they all said the same thing. Your age started to slip up on you now, because I started out, like, when they first seen me, I was 21, and then I didn't sign with Chicago White Sox or with Pittsburgh, Cincinnati Reds at that time. And they all offered me $300 a month, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And I asked them for a $20,000 bonus, and then none of them would give it. So that's when they were passing big bonuses around at that time. But it's just one of those funny things that happened, and then 5 years later, I ended up in 1965 signing with Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. Where did they send you?
They sent me to Batavia, New York, in the New York Penn League, and I stayed there for 3 weeks, and then I went from there to pitching an exhibition game against Cleveland in Pittsburgh. And I won that game up there in pitched 3 and got to win in that game. And then the next day they sent me back to Columbus, Ohio, AAA. And then I spent there the last 3 weeks. And then I went up with the big club and pitched batting practice the last 3 weeks of the season there. And then next spring I made the club in 66.
Mm-hmm. When you were a first-year player in the minor leagues, do you recall who your manager was?
Let me see. I had not really. Who was it? I can't think of his name up there. I've been playing with Manny Sanguin and those guys up there in Batavia, New York, but I can't think of the guy's name.
How about in Columbus? Do you remember
Columbus
your
that I had Larry Shepard.
Larry Shepard.
He was pitching coach at Cincinnati Reds later on in the Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
But he was my pitching my manager in Columbus, and then of course I went up to the big club in Pittsburgh the same year in 65, and that was Harry Walker.
Mm-hmm. It didn't take you very long to get to the majors, a year and a half maybe?
Well, actually it was
2 years.
What it amounted down to was about 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was signed in July of 1965, and then I played the rest of that year in the minor leagues and went to the big club to work out with them the last 2 weeks. Then the next year in 66, I made the big club.
So you started out the 66 season right there with Pittsburgh.
Right, with Pittsburgh. But see, I had a little advantage. I was already 25 years old, so they couldn't wait too long. But they waited 5 years before they signed me because of money.
Then you stayed with Pittsburgh for 2 years, 66 and 67.
I was with Pittsburgh for 2 years, and then I was traded in the Jim Bunning deal from here. Bunning came over to Pittsburgh for myself, Don Money, and Bill Laxton, and some cash.
Mm-hmm.
And that deal, then I came over here and stayed here until 72 in Philly, and then when I was traded to Detroit.
Okay, so you go over to the American League. Were the umpires different?
Well, I think the strike zone might have been a little bit different. I think you get more high pitches in the American League at that time. I think they've kind of tightened it up about the same now. I don't think it's that much difference in this league and that league now. But at that time, in 72 and 3 and 4, it was a little different. You got more high strikes at that time.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to change your strategy for the American League parks?
No, I never changed anything. I think the pitchers got the advantage when you go to another league that they haven't seen you. I think the key is throwing strikes. And I know when I went there, Tony Taylor was on the club, which I played with here in Philly. And he told me, he said, throw the ball hard and throw the ball over the plate. He says, you'll win. And so I was 10-2 the last 2 months of the season with Detroit. Well, of course, that year, they had a pretty good ball club. We almost won the pennant against Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up beating us in the playoffs, and I pitched the last game. Got to be 2-1 in 72.
Mm-hmm. When you were with the Tigers, did you have a favorite catcher? Did you feel more comfortable with one catcher than another?
Well, Duke Sims came over in a deal about the same time as I did, and he caught just about every game I pitched, and everything worked out real well for us. Of course, Freehand was there at the time, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he caught me the last game in the playoffs, and we ended up losing the game 2-1, but I don't think we can gripe about that. We just didn't hit the ball like we should.
Mm-hmm. When you were pitching for Detroit as a left-hander, were there any left-handed batters that gave you a lot of trouble?
Well, I think left-handed batters never liked to face me that well. I think the biggest problem when I was in the American League, if a left-handed batter, you'd have to say Yaz for Boston. He always hit the ball well, whoever was pitching for us. But the left-hander gave me the most trouble than anybody was Billy Williams with the Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the National League. But I wasn't in the American League that long, and maybe if I'd stayed there longer, more left-handers would have given me more trouble, the more they saw me.
Mm-hmm. Now, your manager in Detroit.
Well, while I was there, I had two. I had Billy Martin when I first went there in 72, and then I had Ralph Houck after that when I was there in 72, 73, and then in 74.
So Sparky hadn't got there yet.
Sparky hadn't got there.
But he would have been still with Cincinnati.
I had Sparky and with the Reds when I was traded there.
Now, after Detroit, you go to?
When I left to Detroit, I went back to Montreal. I went to Montreal the first time, not back to Montreal. But that's where I went to from there. And that in 76 was when we lost 106 ball games. And they switched over to all young kids. We had like 6 rookies in the lineup, playing every day. And then they had some older guys on their way out, so we really struggled. But it was probably the best year I ever had pitching. Really, I was 13-13 that year with Montreal with a bad club. And it's just one of those things that the guys played good behind me, and some of the other guys, they didn't really at that time. But like I said, we did have a bad club.
Mm-hmm. When you were pitching every fourth day, and you were going out there every day, were you a strikeout pitcher or a ground ball pitcher?
I was pretty well a strikeout pitcher in my earlier days in the game. I'd say for the first probably 6-7 years that I pitched in major leagues. I was a strikeout pitcher. I usually averaged 7 to 8, I mean, a game in 9 innings most times. But then after I got older and hurt my arm a few times, I become more of a ground ball pitcher. Mm-hmm. And I get a strikeout once in one occasion, but mostly ground ball pitcher that time.
Was it hard for you to alter your style when you got older?
Well, I think it alters you if you want to stay in the big leagues, because you lose your little fastball a little bit over if you're the place you started. But what helped me more than anything else to help alter my style was when they put me in the bullpen. And that's something I didn't think I could do, because I didn't think my arm would let me throw every day and enough, you know, to really pitch in the bullpen. But it did, and then I got another 5 years in the big leagues pitching in the bullpen and doing a pretty decent job as short man. And then I could throw hard for 1 inning or 2 innings and didn't have to worry about trying to throw for, you know, 7 or 8 innings or 9 or whatever.
How about of all the managers that you've had, which one did you like the
most? Maybe one, and there was Gene Mock. He's the best manager in baseball. And the top five, you have Gene Mock, you have Billy Martin, you have Ralph Houck, you have Dick Williams, and you have Danny Murtaugh. Mm-hmm. That's far as it goes.
Mm-hmm. Did you play for Danny Murtaugh also?
I played for all of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say Gene was the best. What made him the best? Was his strategy?
He knew the game, the strategy. He just never had the players the other managers had to win with. What he had, he got the most out of everything he ever had. And if you ever talk to a ball player who played for Gene Mock, you got more respect for him than anybody else. Or maybe not to press, maybe not to some of the fans, and everyone on the inside of the game. But I played for him when he was on both sides, when he was really what you call temperament, really. When I was here with Philly with him, he really had a temper and stuff. If you lost a ball game, he would sit on the valuable box maybe an hour and a half. If you didn't play well, you wouldn't leave the clubhouse. That was, he got off from it. He might not say a word, but he'd sit there. But he got his point over. You knew what you did wrong. If you played well, got beat 2-1, 1-0, played good, he'd pat you on the back. We get him tomorrow. But that's just the way it was. But then he went through the change of ball players, you know, all the years he managed, and the temperaments changed, and they had to mellow a little bit to stay in the big leagues, and he changed a whole lot. But I don't really think he was as good a manager on the end because of that as he was before. But he had to communicate with the players, because the players changed. Mm-hmm. But Gene, to me, was the best manager that ever managed the game in modern baseball, as far as I'm concerned.
As a pitcher, you had to depend a lot on your fielders, particularly in your later years. Is there anybody that you'd like to see behind you in a tight game?
Well, the best two that I ever played with, I thought, in 1966, I had Gene Alley and Bill Mazeroski. They were the best two ever played in the middle and while I played the game. There's been a lot of good ones now. I'm talking about the two guys, day in and day out, played every game. They were the best, as far as I'm concerned, at the teams I played with. Of course, like I said, I played with a lot of good ones. But those two together, they was amazing.
When you look at the game now, Woody, do you see the same game?
Well, it's the same game, but it's the different people playing it. The game hasn't changed. The people in it has changed. They're spoiled. A lot of them are overall. And it's not the players' fault. It's the owners. Because the owners took advantage of the players so many years when they didn't pay them nothing. And I don't feel sorry for the owners at all today. I think they got just exactly what they deserved because they brought it on themselves. The players didn't bring it on. They brought it on themselves. And now, players, to me, I'm disappointed the way they play because now they're making all that money and a lot of them don't give a good effort. For some guys, if you give them $3 million to play hard, but 8 out of 10 won't. So that's when you have bad baseball. But that's just part of the game. There's nothing you can do about that. You just have to hope you can get enough guys together to go out and compete every day and you know, and win. But the game hasn't changed for it. I think the calling of the game of the umpires has changed. Now you got to throw the ball down the middle of the plate before they call the strike, and it's got to be a blow the belt before they call the strike. And it's just they got a little zone there. And I don't think we can class our pitching today as pitching, say, 10 years ago. Because now if you make a pitch on the black or that you should make or up or down, they'll call it a ball if they don't swing. So, you know, that's why the pitching's not quite as good, I think, overall.
Speaking with Woody Freiman today at the Phillies Old Timers Weekend, Woody, you and the umpires, did you get along with everybody when you pitched?
I had no problem whatsoever with no umpire. If I thought I was been squeezed on a pitch, I'd question it. I never throwed out of a game in my life. At all the 8 years that I played, and some of them said they kind of get a scope out when I walked on the mound, like I was kind of scoping them a little bit. But I figured if you made the pitch, you should get the strike. If you didn't, it's a ball. It's just that simple. And it's just, I think an umpire, if he knows what you're trying to do, and if you go out and give your best day in, day out, they'll leave you alone and you leave them alone. And if you do get kind of up in a hissy once in a while, if they know what type of person they are, they're not going to throw you out of the ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not, then they know if you're hot-headed and really want something for nothing, you'll take a hike in a hurry.
When you were with Pittsburgh, Roberto Clemente was there then. What kind of a player was he?
Well, in modern baseball in those years, that I'm talking about back from the early 60s to the 80s, you'd have to take Roberto and Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and put them all together and say which one's the best. Everybody's got their own opinion. As far as me, he's 1, 2, 3, and you put them in any class you want. Whoever you want to put it first of those three, that was the three best ones in the National League. Now, I'm not going to the American League because I wasn't over at that time. But those were the three best guys and those in that year when he was playing in anybody. Roberto could do everything and do it as well as anybody. Great player. Hello, Tony. The old goat.
I wanted to cover another aspect of your career, Woody, particularly in your later years. Some of the way the writers would describe you, they would describe you as a cold-weather pitcher. Were you aware that you were known as a cold-weather pitcher?
Oh, yes.
Did you like it that way?
My arm didn't like it, but I liked it because hitters don't want to play in cold weather. They always afraid they're going to get jammed. And I pitched inside all my career, and I like to throw the ball on the knuckles. In cold weather, that's the time to pitch inside. Hot weather is not. Mm-hmm. And hitters don't like to face you when it's cold, and they'll get out of the box and back up, and then you just keep crowding them, and you'll get people out. And I always enjoyed that, the pitching at people inside, like old goat Tony Taylor there. But but they always call me a cold weather pitcher. I didn't mind the hot weather when I was pitching, because I worked in hot weather in the tobacco fields all my life, and that didn't bother me either. But I think it made me a little bit better pitcher in cold weather just because of the hitters didn't want to play in cold weather, and that made me feel a little more confident in myself, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the stadiums that you played in, did you have a favorite or one you didn't like so much, maybe?
A lot of them I didn't like. Well, the best parts that I pitched in that I really enjoyed was Astrodome and St. Louis. That's the best two parts for any pitcher to pitch in, I think. You throw strikes and try to keep the ball down, and you'll get a lot of fly ball outs and ground balls, and just pop-up won't go out of the park. Now, in Chicago, with the wind blowing out, it's just, it's ungodly how easy the ball is to hit out. And then when you go to Boston, it's the same way. To me, both parks ought to be tore down, putting two new ones up, to be fair with the other parks. And they have better ball teams, because they build a team around that ballpark. You go somewhere else, that ballpark's not there. Mm-hmm. And that's why they don't win, and they don't understand that. Mm-hmm. Of course, winning pennants in the World Series.
Right.
But they should, to me, Major League ball players ought to play in the same dimensions in every park.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be 330 down the line, 385 in the alleys, and 400 in center field, and put them all the same. And they would have no griping who's the best hitter, who's the best home run hitter, and that's whoever would end up ahead would be the best that year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it should be.
And how about this turf versus grass?
Oh, well, I think any human would rather play on grass because it's better for your legs, it's better everything, but you're going back to the dollar again.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to be, you won't have as many rainouts, you maintain it much easier with the turf, and that's why it's done. It ain't because it helps the game, it hurts the game. Baseball's being played on grass and dirt, just that simple. But, we're playing modern baseball again, so you have to go back to that.
Mm-hmm. And when you got to the end of your career, did you want to stay in the game in another capacity?
Well, at that time, no, because, I'd been traveling 18 years, and my wife, their fellow, she'd raised both kids. I'd been gone all that time, and they'd grown up, and it's really tough. You got kids in school, and you're with other clubs, and you're not close to where you live, and you're always gone, and actually, you spend about 2 months at home in the wintertime, but then you had to go to spring training and stay 6 weeks. So it's really tough for everybody, really, the family. Now, I think the game of baseball is made for a single man, if you want to be honest about the whole game. That's what it should be. Nobody should be married in baseball. It would be much easier on everybody because you'd have no responsibility but just a game on the field. And that's where we go. But now, in the game where you travel and stuff and gone all the time, it's really tough for the family. And it's amazing how some of the wives does as well as they do with the kids and get them through school and the things they have to do and responsibilities at home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tough game. People don't understand that part of it. They just see the traveling and the money you make and all this, but it's a lot more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. With me today is Woody Freiman, left-handed pitcher for the Phillies during the 70s and also with the Pirates and what other teams?
I was with the Cubs and with the Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm. And then back,
Montreal
and then back to Montreal.
Right.
Two tours of duty in Montreal. You have trouble with the language up there?
Well, I always told the miss up there, I said, I can't speak English too well, so I won't have no trouble. I can't speak French, so you all just have to try to make me out, and I'll try to make you out, so we never had no problems.
Now, the tobacco business. You're back in that, you always were in that to begin with.
Well, we raised tobacco all of our lives, still do, on the same farm, and milk and dairy herd on the farm, but the business, and both of them is very poor right now. I mean, the milk has gone down to nothing, and the tobacco business has been down for 5 years, so it's a tough life. The family farm is just about on its way out, to be mm-hmm. honest with you. It's the big business is trying to crowd it out, and I don't know what people's going to do in the areas where you're in farm country, and that's all you do is farm. Because dairy businesses went from $16 a hundred down to $10 a hundred, and there's no business would do that to anybody, because mm-hmm. you just can't exist. Tobacco 5 years ago went from right $1.90 a pound down to $1.57. Now it's took us 5 years to get back to $1.87 in 5 years. So, you know, it's just, they're trying to squeeze everybody out, I would say. But I don't know how the farmers going to make it in the area where I live in Kentucky, and especially where that's your number one crop is tobacco and the dairy business. Mm-hmm. So it's really hurting everybody.
We had another tobacco farmer from Kentucky working in Philadelphia the last few years that went back there, named Buddy Ryan.
But, yeah. Well, you know, I think...
Do you see him in Kentucky?
No, I don't. I think the biggest thing, now, if you want to know about a farmer, I think the biggest thing, you know, you was brought up there, you was raised there, that's all you really knew at the time, and most usually that's all you wanted to know, because that's all you did. And most farmers back in my day, when I was born on the farm, you never had any money to spend to start with. You were a close-knitted family, you stayed at home, you'd go to a ball game or something, a sandlot ball, and you'd play or play a little bit of softball overnight, because you had no money to go anywhere else anyhow, and everybody didn't have a car those days to run in, especially kids. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how you become a farmer and really want to stay on the land, and that's your life, because that's all you really knew. But I would advise no young kid today to stay on the farm. Nobody, mine or anybody else, my two boys work with me on the farm, because there's no money and the government's going to see you're not going to get any. It's just that simple. Mm-hmm. So if I was a kid today on the farm, I'd go get a factory job anywhere I could get it.
Mm-hmm. With me is Woody Freiman in town for the Old Timers game. Woody, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about your career and some of your experiences in the major leagues. And good luck tonight.
Thank you. I'll need it.
Good morning. This is Dan DiNardo with the Society for American Baseball Research. We're in Philadelphia today. It's August the 10th, 1991, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the opening of Veterans Stadium. And with me today is Montreal catcher Ron Brand, who was with Montreal when the stadium opened up in 1971. Ron, welcome to Philadelphia. It's good to see you again.
Thank you. It's nice to be back here, Dan.
Ron, I got a 1963 Pirate yearbook with your picture in it. You recognize yourself?
Yeah. Pretty young. Reminds me of one of my kids.
Now, started out with Pittsburgh all the way back in 1958?
Yes, in their minor league system. I started at San Jose.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and the... Did you make the Pirate team before you went to Montreal?
Yes, I did. I came up with the Pirates in 63, was there most of the year, and then the following year I was drafted by Houston in the minor league draft. The Pirates left me on a AAA roster, and Houston picked me up, and I was fortunate to play there for 4 years, and then moved on to Montreal in the expansion draft in 1968. Mm-hmm. And started there in 1969 with the Expos.
Mm-hmm. When you got to the majors with the Expos, who was the manager then?
Gene Locke.
Gene? Yeah. Okay, now, out of all the managers you played for, which manager was your favorite?
Well,
not
Gene
your favorite,
Locke,
but which one would you rate as the highest?
Gene Locke is head and shoulders above anybody that ever managed, as far as I'm concerned. I learned more in the years I was with him than I did in my whole baseball career. That's not to say that other guys didn't teach me a lot, but he kept it a simple game, with simple logic. He'd just make a little one-sentence statement and say, you know, why don't you do this, or doesn't it make sense to do that? And I still see major leaguers not doing things that would help them score a run in the ninth inning, running off second base, you know, if they would do it the proper way. And nobody else in baseball ever approached that. Plus the fact that he was innings ahead. I remember an incident when Dick Williams was our coach in 1970. And we were sitting on a bench there, and Gene did something, I can't remember what, made some move, and Dick Williams looked at me and he says, boy, I thought I knew baseball. And here's a guy that had already been to the World Series as a manager. He says, I thought I knew baseball. He says, well, this guy is unbelievable. And, you know, I just wish, and I'd give anything if they would have Angels wouldn't have given up that home run to Dave Henderson a few years back, and he would have gotten the World Series, because that's just a wrong that he never got into a World Series, as good a manager as he was. And he was a fair man. A lot of guys couldn't accept his approach, but if you would play hard and do what he asked you to do, he would go to the wall for you. Mm-hmm. And that's all you can ask.
Mm-hmm. As a catcher, Ron, who impressed you the most as a pitcher in your career?
Well, you mean the ones I caught?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Well, at Houston.
Or the ones you didn't catch?
Yeah, well, of course, Sandy Koufax was on a class. He was on a level by himself, because he was the only man I ever saw that could just absolutely overpower any hitter. And, in fact, the guys that had the best chance were little guys like me who just had a short stroke, because if you took a big swing at him, the ball moved so much and had such velocity, and his curveball was just outstanding, straight down.
Mm-hmm.
And such a difference from his fastball that he was just plain overpowering. You knew when he pitched, if you got one run, you better hope your pitcher pitched a shutout. And the pitchers I caught Mike Cuellar in Houston, Don Wilson, Dave Justy, Larry Durker. Got to catch Robin Roberts there.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he was on at the end of his career, he pitched a couple of ball games for us that were masterpieces, because he put the ball absolutely in the glove every time. Shut out the Pirates and the Phillies. That was at 65 when they had some real thunder. So I was fortunate to be with some fine pitchers. And then in Montreal, we had Bill Stoneman, and I got, of course, I caught Burrell Roy Face and Bob Friend and Vernon Law in Pittsburgh, Harvey Haddix. So I had a chance to be with some fine pitchers, but I would rate Koufax as the best overall pitcher I ever saw.
Mm-hmm. How about Pittsburgh as an organization? How did they treat you?
I love those guys. I mean, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, North Hollywood, and they scouted me in high school, and I played winter ball. Bailey and I, Tommy Sisk, played together in kind of a semi-pro league for young minor leaguers and high school and college players, and they ran that team. They took care of us. They had a great organization. It was like a family, and I was a little upset when I did finally get there in 1963. I hit 288, backing up Burgess and Aguirone, and played three or four positions for them. And the next spring, they, before spring training even started, they had me designated to go back to Columbus, and that didn't seem right to me, but it turned out to be a break, because then Houston picked me off that roster, and I got to catch regular in Houston in 65. So we'll never know. I would have loved to stay in Pittsburgh, because I came up with all those guys, Blass, Veal, Bob Pretty, Manny Mota came up that same year, Willie Stargell, all great friends. I would have liked to have been a part of the success that they had.
Mm-hmm. When you were with the majors with Pittsburgh, who was the manager?
Danny Murtaugh. And if you want to talk about a favorite person, he was it. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful man. Made you feel important. I can remember having my little three-year-old son out at the ballpark one day, and Danny would take him off out of the stands and sit him in the dugout on his knee, you know, before the game, and just made a young player like me feel that he cared about us.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went back and managed the Pittsburgh organization, and Danny was the manager again in 1974, and it was really nice to meet with him again. And he was an honest man. When he sent me out that spring in 64, he came in, he said, "You have every right to be upset." He said, "This decision was made, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Just do the best you can with it." And I probably didn't. I probably said some things I shouldn't have said and made somebody mad, but that was all resolved later. Joe Brown was, I consider, a dear friend. And they're my family in baseball.
Now, the Montreal organization, what were they like?
Well, that was great too, because see, this was a start of a new complete franchise. We had 40 some guys in spring training, all thrown together from different ball clubs, and we had to develop an attitude and a stature. And we had a horrible 1969. I don't know how Gene got through it, but he did. And then we set a goal for 70 wins in 70, and we surpassed that. And that was a great thrill. And the fans in Montreal were great. They We had a parade there when we first got there in 69, and there was a million people lying in the streets throwing confetti. It was like MacArthur coming home. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe it. And they treated us that way the whole time I was there. I understand they're not having a success drawing now, but in those days, they supported us 100%. So it made it easier to try to build a ball club. And Rusty went wild there, you know, and became a star. And Bob Bailey came into his own there, and Mac Jones. And mm-hmm. So it was fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you stay in the game after you retired?
I did for 3 years. And then I, with six children, I just couldn't hack it anymore at the minor league level. I had to get out and raise my family, so that's what I've done. Mm-hmm. We've now raised eight children. Two small ones are still 11 and 9, but they're both boys, and they're both involved in baseball. And I'm making noises about getting back in some capacity. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of instructing and stuff around my hometown, give clinics and things like that, and they've been well received. And so we're going in that direction, maybe open up a batting cage or an instructional facility, something like that.
Now, are you back in California now?
Yes, in Roseville, up Northern California.
Northern California?
I went there because there were some construction opportunities, which I've been a general contractor now for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ron Brand has been my guest today. The Society for American Baseball Research wants to thank you, Ron, for stopping by, giving us your thoughts, and we wish you good luck tonight.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's been nice meeting you, and nice to be asked a question again.
Okay.